This is Mary Franklin at 65 Wood Green on the 10th of December, and I'm interviewing
Juliet Curry.
Thank you, Juliet. So let me start by asking you how you came to live in Witney.
Well, we were living in Charlbury very happily, and we'd had a little girl, and it was a tiny cottage. We wanted something quite a lot bigger. Roger wanted an office at home. We used to come into Witney to do the shopping. We always loved Witney. So we decided we'd just have to sell Charlbury, move to Witney, which we did in 1988, when little girl was about a year old. And prices in Witney were a lot cheaper than Charlbury. We fell utterly in love with this house because it had plenty of room for Roger's office and work rooms and a big garden. Loved Witney from the day we moved in. It only had one cafe in those days, and of course 28 pubs, but from the year that we moved here, it got better and better. The number of cafes, the number of pubs was restaurants, the shops, everything. It's got a fantastic library, doctor's service. Everything you can think of is in Witney, except for the railway, of course, but Witney has everything you could possibly want. We absolutely love it. We'd never dream of moving anywhere else. We do hope that the high street remains pedestrian only because we just love it like that. The green spaces in Witney are just amazing. No other town I can think of has as many green spaces open to the public. And the river running through and the common are so special. So it's a perfect town in our eyes, and the fact that it has had a wonderful industry means that people living here are interesting because lots of them have worked in the business here and that's their experience. It isn't a town full of tourists, thank goodness. It's a working town and that's why we love it.
Okay, that sounds great. So do you have a favourite place where you like to go if you're going out for coffee or to meet friends? Is there a favourite spot?
Delice in the High Street, run by Miguel. We just love him. We go at least twice a week. He's so friendly and the coffee's very good.
Excellent. And do you think Witney has a sort of real sense of community?
Oh, yes. Oh, very much so. Yes, I do. Mm-hmm. I think the people here are really homogeneous and very friendly, and there's an awful lot going on in the town. Arts, if you like, and music and community groups, and the U3A is enormous. And it's a pub culture. People meet in pubs. We've only got 26 pubs now, but we all meet in pubs.
And do you have a favourite one of those?
Well, we go to two. There's the Elm Tree in West End, and there's the Plough in the High Street. So yes, those are the two favourites.
Okay. So you came here in 88. Were you already involved in knitting machines and things to do with knitting at that point?
Yes, yes. Okay. Roger had developed the machine in about 1981, 82. We were living in London at that time. And just he and I, really. Now, Roger is an engineer and an inventor, and we were manufacturing in Birmingham. And in 82, he had won the Innovator of the Year Award from the Observer newspaper. He got first prize. And that set us on the road to manufacturing. He had spent 2 years prior to that at the drawing board in our tiny flat, thinking how he could invent something with much more modern materials than solid steel, which is very heavy. And it took him, just about 2 years to invent the Bond. It was called the Bond because he was walking down Bond Street to his lawyers and said to me, "I've got 5 minutes before I get there. We've got to think of a name." We've been thinking of a name for about 6 months. And I said, "Oh, Bond, Bond, Bond. You're going down Bond Street." He said, "Okay, that's the word." So it became the Bond knitting machine.
Oh, was that the first knitting machine?
Yes, that one there.
Okay, so what knitting machines were available on the market?
Well, they're all made in Japan. Brother, Empersal, some other names I can't remember now, but they were very, very special. They were sold in specialist knitting machine shops. They were about £200 to £800. They were incredibly complicated with all sorts of mechanisms for separating the yarn when it's fed into the machine. You could only do 2, 3, 4 ply and maybe double knitting. Mm. They were not yarns that were fashionable at that time in the 80s. We were wearing double knit Icelandic yarns, chunky chenille, mohair. None of those things could be knitted on the Japanese machines. And you couldn't even lift them, it was so heavy. So the popular yarns were these, and I'd always hand knitted, Roger can hand knit. And he decided that he could do a whole lot better by having a modern material. It was called acetal, which is a really nice, firm plastic. And so he invented a machine which would knit the yarns we were using in Europe. And he entered this for the competition of the Observer newspaper. And he had to do a demonstration, which of course he could do easily. And it knits, an inch a minute? So you could do about 5 rows in a minute. You just go across leisurely like this with your right arm, knitting and knitting. It had 100 needles, so you could do quite a decent width. And the judges were frightfully impressed and gave him first prize. And the first prize, it doesn't sound much now, but it was £10,000. And it paid for the worldwide patents, which was incredibly important in those days because the Japanese, we knew, were going to try and copy. They didn't, as it happens, because their technology was based in steel needles, steel beds.
Yeah.
And Rogers was totally innovative. And the fact that he invented this key plate system where you could change the size of the stitches so easily was an absolute winner. The instruction books were all written in pictures. Very few words, so it meant that translation to foreign languages was jolly easy. And a friend of ours did all the illustrations, and it was mainly me knitting away, sitting there smiling, and so the instructions, drawings, and then the patterns we got going. The yarn spinners loved the machine because it knitted yarn very quickly, and we could get through a lot of yarn. They were very happy to do joint promotions with us where we were in magazines, women's magazines, knitting magazines. We would do a joint promotion. They would supply the yarn kit, we would supply the bond, and then we would write the pattern with the bond instructions. And that was very, very successful with promotions and competitions. And they would sell kits of yarn with the machines. Because we found it very demonstratable, so easy. Once you looked at it, you could really get going quickly. The first sale we made was to Woolco, which at that time had 100 of those big superstores. And they bought the first order. I think it was 1,000 machines, the first order. And Roger and I were practically assembling them with the manufacturers in the West Midlands who were plastic moulders. So it was very, and you used to drive the van, and I used to be in there, and we used to drive up to the nearest, wherever it was, Southampton, Portsmouth, Hampshire. Those were the first sales in the south.
Mm.
And you used to go in with your brown warehouse coat into the van and say, I've parked at the back, then change into your suit and go to the front and say, I'm the manager of Bond Knitting, I've come to talk about, you know, your next order. And I would have my smart suit on, and I would go in and I'd say, I'm the marketing director, I want to train some of your staff. Have you got them in the interview room? Go in, interview these girls who already had a bond. They were people who were enthusiastic about it. And we trained them, and they would demonstrate on a Saturday all day for commission. And it just took off. And so we did our first trade exhibition, knitting and stitching show, I think after about 3 months, and we got mobbed by independent wool shops who said, we love it. All we're selling is yarn at 89 pence a ball, 1.99, 3.99. This sells for £69 and we can make, you know, a 40% markup.
Yes.
Because Roger had no middlemen. They were making it for us and we sold direct to the shops. So the margins were very good. And the shops loved it because they had to demonstrate it. It caused a bit of a fuss on a Saturday morning, you know. The girls were earning, what did they get? 10% commission, 20% commission or something. They loved it. We had tremendous success in that first year, tremendous success. So we quickly got secretary, typist, sales clerk. So we had to move from Chiswick and we came up to Whitney for an office. And we were in Bridge Street Mill, where Jill Stew Dance Studio is now. It's still there. And we had our warehouse there and ran the sales force, which was all over the country. And my background was in merchant banking, marketing, in merchant banking. And so I was very able to go to the stores and train people. And within about 5 years, we had 120 staff all around the country. And they were a whole mixture of salesmen, regional managers, in-store demonstrators, knitwear designers, sample knitters, graphic designers, advertising and promotional staff, almost all of them freelance. But in Witney, we had 21 staff, didn't we? And that was really just sales. And from Bridge Street Mill, we outgrew that, and we moved to an office, 69 High Street. We had a nice office there, incredibly old furniture and old rooms, weren't they? And we loved it there, and right in the centre of town, of course. By then, we'd moved from Charlbury into Witney, so we were very happy working and living here. And we began the export business, I think, by the end of the first year, and our first exports really were America. And we hadn't realised that American women, and still are, the biggest hobbyists in the world. They all do a lot of hobby work. They're into, you know, patchwork, tapestries, knitting, crochet, everything you could think of. And in fact, the bond is still sold in America. So we went to America trade shows, and we did four a year, didn't we? Anaheim, Chicago, Florida somewhere, Houston. And Roger and I were working together all this time, selling. Very successful. Roger got approached by QVC in California, who did a test of the bond in California. They ordered 100,000 units. Roger had to swallow twice to think, can I actually make 100,000 just for the American market? Well, we did, of course, because our supplier of the plastic machines in West Midlands was very happy to double, triple. Our staff kept growing and growing. Then we began exporting the next year, and we did the continent. So we were doing, France were never interested because they don't have department stores. But Roger was selling to South Africa, Zimbabwe, Kenya, didn't do to Russia, Norway, Sweden, Denmark, obviously, and Germany, and where else? Spain, Switzerland. So that was very exciting. And we had to get translators, of course, for the instruction books.
And did the machine change at all for different countries?
No, the instruction books changed, but that was it. Then Roger, by about year three, produced another machine, which was called the Elite, and that did four ply and double knitting for those people who just wanted to make, you know, children's things and baby things. And that also was a great success. And because he's an inventor, he was always inventing other things. It would be counters to go on the machine to count the rows, or it'd be sewing up gadgets, or it would be, what else did you invent? All sorts of things to go with the machine. So it was just such an exciting time. And then, of course, fashions change, and by about 1994-5, China was producing most of the knitwear in this country, and that wasn't chunky and beautiful and expensive, it was cheap, and people stopped really knitting quite so much, and they were buying ready-made knitwear. And so our sales tailed off, and Roger made the decision that we would sell the company to an American firm who were really gung-ho, because American sales had outstripped every other country in the world. We were doing 60% export, but American sales outstripped us, and he decided that over the next few years he would sell to an American firm. So he did. We'd got past the peak by then, and people would... We did have 365 independent wool shops had our machine, including the one in Witney, the wool shop, now then the lighting shop, now it's empty. We had all the department stores, we had John Lewis throughout the country, all the House of Fraser stores, which I sold to, the Lewis chain, who else is there? Debenhams, obviously, then all the mail order catalogues we sold to. So, and We didn't see Japanese machines after that. I think, in fact, they withdrew from the market because they're just simply, unless they were selling to small industries, we had a monopoly. And that was in America, Britain, and I'm not sure what happened in Europe, but we certainly, the Japanese did try and copy. They used to raid our stand early in the morning and try and take a machine away, but they didn't succeed. And they never produced a machine in our price range. I mean, £69, you know, it's not much for a very, very useful thing to have in the house. It's what the price of a food mixer or something. So women were really keen to have one here and elsewhere. So it was, as I say, incredibly exciting times. And we were so glad that we were in Witney. Staff loved working for us because it was still innovative. It was exciting. They loved working with new yarns and they loved working with the yarn companies. And we had a magazine with 25,000 circulation, which I wrote most of it, I think. And we did patterns and editorials and interviews and letters page and problem page. And that was very successful too.
So you wrote the patterns as well?
No, that's not my fault. I'm just just sales really. So, and I could write. So I wrote lots of the magazine bits and bobs. And we just loved that magazine, didn't we? It was a great success. And that was taken on by the Americans. And then they got their own patterns and designers to write patterns for them.
What was the magazine called?
The Bond Magazine.
Of course.
Quite simple.
Yes. Yes,
I haven't got a copy to show you. I didn't think about that, but yes, it was a fun thing to do for all those years. We started, I think, about the third year we'd got going. We realised that people wanted to have a follow up, you know, and then in the last years that we had the company, Roger was taken up by Martha Stewart. Is that a name that you know? She's a guru in America. She's like a Delia Smith and a sewing expert all rolled into one. And she was on TV an awful lot. And she wanted a Martha Stewart knitting machine. So Roger designed one for her, horrible, bright pink. Anyway, and it was mainly for sort of teenagers that she wanted it. It was sold in Walmart. And she's still got it in Walmart now, in this year. Well, we went.
She's
still selling. And she wanted Roger to invent a weaving loom, which he did. And that was inexpensive and pink plastic. So his inventions went on long after he'd sold the company, actually. And the yarn company bought it in America, in the yarn center of America, in North Carolina. And they tied Roger in for 3 years, which was quite cruel, but essential for our income, to invent more products for them. And so he would spend a week every month in North Carolina thinking of new things and yarn ideas. And we had an American partner, Carrie Clement, who was very inventive, and she and he used to spend a lot of time with the new owner in America. So it didn't die, it just sort of transformed into another company. So Roger eventually was able to leave the whole thing behind about 20 years ago, I guess. So it had a second life, which was very happy.
So why was it that Roger decided to invent a knitting machine? Because it's clearly been hugely successful, but of course you didn't know that it was going to have that degree of success perhaps at the time.
I knew. Yes.
Okay.
When he entered the competition from the Observer Newspaper Award, they said, it's so sexy because you can demonstrate it and the yarn you're using is very tactile. The whole thing is sexy. And we thought, it is. But Roger had just been working as managing director of a company. He was in merchant banking as well, along a different company from me. And he was made managing director of one of the client companies who were importing knitting machines from Japan and sewing machines. And when he saw the knitting machine, he thought, interesting, but totally wrong for Europe. It'll never, never work. And so I kept on with my bank. Roger spent 2 years at home on a drawing board, working it out, getting samples made, getting tooling made, getting things that did work, didn't work. It was a very difficult time for us. Financially, it was very, very risky because he had to spend money on getting tooling made and we weren't sure it was going to work. But after 2 years, he had this product.
Yeah.
Just the one, showed it to the Observer newspaper innovator team. That was it.
Mm.
That was it. Publicity was amazing in the Observer. And with that in our hand, we went to Woolco, the buyer there, and he just loved it. And having got into Woolco, we then were set because John Lewis and House of Fraser were interested in seeing it and talking to us. But they'd all seen us at the trade shows, working away, wearing the sweaters, talking about it, knitting an inch a minute, using all these gorgeous fluffy yarns, and they were sold immediately.
The other thing which used to amuse us was the Japanese, who were, in my experience, totally deceitful. I've done business with them. Can't trust them an inch because their attitude to what is right and wrong is quite different to us.
Yeah.
They say their view is, if it's right for Japan, it's right. Whereas we, you know, it's just a funny idea. Anyway, we'd go into a trade show, and then the next thing you knew, one of your machines had disappeared.
Well, they didn't, no, but they were taking photographs. And
taking photographs,
yes.
And stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm. They knew a good idea when they saw one.
They didn't know why it was successful.
Yes.
They kept saying, but it's not steel, it won't last. Well, mine's 48 years old and I'm still using it. You know, they're tough, but they're very lightweight. You could, it only weighed, 4 pounds? You can carry it around, you know.
Yes,
so can you describe the machine and the size of the machine a little bit more?
Yes, it's, how many inches is it?
We get one down.
No, it's just there. It's got 100 needles. The needles are steel. The base is made of acetyl, which is slightly... what's the word I'm wanting? So it doesn't feel liquid. It's just very incredibly smooth. And you have a handle which you push left and right, and it knits an inch a minute. It's very easy to set up. You've got clamps. You can put it onto a table, so it's very strong. It comes with instruction books. It comes with key plates for different stitch sizes. It comes with a pattern book, so you can make basic shapes, V-neck, round neck, sleeves, non-sleeves for men, women and children to get you started. And after that, you can send away for patterns, or we had patterns in all the women's magazines over the years, didn't we?
Mm-hmm.
They were very happy to print them. And the yarn spinners, as I say, loved it because it knitted a lot of yarn. You could make a quick sweater in an evening and sew it up the next day and wear it at the weekend, which you can't do with hand knitting, you see. But it would look like hand knitting.
Yeah.
And you could do Fair Isle, as he's wearing, cable, all sorts of clever stitches.
Julia won't remember this. When we went into these department stores in the early days, suddenly women would see this thing and they'd all start saying, have you seen such and such? And they'd all start getting around the machine and the whole store would be blocked up with every record.
They thought it was fascinating.
It was a magnet.
And I used to get told off
You blocked the aisle, yes.
You can't do this.
But you can imagine, if you've got 30 minutes, you can make the whole back of a sweater in 30 minutes.
Yes.
And then the front, and then the two sleeves. So you could make the sweater pieces,
yes,
a plain one,
mm-hmm,
you know, in 2 or 3 hours,
yeah,
and then, as I say, sew it up the next day.
And was it easy to use if you hadn't done hand knitting?
Oh, yes. People were buying it who'd never hand knitted. They'd always liked the idea of it, but never,
mm-hmm,
could never get the hang of hand knitting. Oh, yes, yes, absolutely. That's why they bought it, probably, yes.
Can you remember what the first thing or the sort of early things were that you made on that machine?
Well, these two. I made this probably the first 2 months, and I made that in about the first 3 or 4 months.
Mm.
Could you describe both of them?
Well, Roger's wearing a very complicated Fair Isle sweater, which I made for him. And on one of our trade shows, the stand next to us was Yorkshire Woolen Mills, or Yorkshire, whatever it was called. And so that one is Swaledale Herdwick, and I think it's got a bit of Black Welsh in there.
Mm.
So I made it and said to the chap who owned the company, well, which I think is, he said, oh, that's amazing. How long did that take you? 3 months? I said, no. No, it only took me about 3 days. Actually, it's quite complicated, but And then I was always wearing something that was heavily patterned or with cable or something. And I had obviously been rehearsing on Roger's early machines how to make things and how to knit quickly and cleverly and do different stitches. So by the time we got going with the real machines, I was quite good at it. Mm-hmm. And I was teaching all these we had how many demonstrators?
Oh, more
than that. Yeah. Every town in the country had them. So you must have had 70 or 80, I suppose, over the years. Must have been all the department stores. And I taught most of them, or I taught the regional managers who then taught them. We spent our early days in a car driving all over the country, either selling to the department store managers or the demonstrators who used to teach in an evening. Then they were on the shop floor the next Saturday.
And can you describe the jumper you're wearing?
Well, it's Icelandic yarn, which I just love. Again, we met somebody from Iceland on a trade show, and she was selling very sturdy Icelandic yarn, which is so warm. And I'm wearing a pink one, which is covered in cables. And it was quite tricky to knit, because it is such a firm yarn. But I absolutely love it, and I'm still wearing it. And I made it in 1982, 83. So it shows you how... Well, I knitted.
And the yarn, of course, would be very strong and durable as well, wouldn't it?
It is.
And the way it's knitted.
Yes. Yeah. We sold to Iceland quite a lot of machines because Vigdis Stefan Dottir and her husband Joseph loved coming to England with an excuse, really, and they were buying machines. And everybody in Iceland, of course, knits like mad because it's so... terribly cold for 9 months of the year, and Vigdis became really expert at knitting on the bond, and they were selling it. They had a shop, and she sold it to her neighbours and so on. So Iceland was always a good little market for us. We never went there to see them, but it was a good little market. In fact, Scandinavia was a good market for us too. I remember going to, we went to Oslo, didn't we, and sold a lot to the Norwegians, and they loved it because they have thick yarn as well, and it knitted beautifully.
Cold winters
which require a well-knit jumper.
Of course, exactly.
Yes. There any countries where you hoped you might have sales but you weren't able to sell there for whatever reason?
Well, Russia, because they got Roger there on false pretenses. They really just wanted, they were probably given handouts for trade commissions of some sort. And so Roger was a single-handed trade commission. He went out there. All they wanted to do was to wine and dine. And they hadn't any employees, actually. They only came in to the factory to have lunch and then go home again. So that was completely false pretenses. You never sold any of them,
in
Russia?
It was extraordinary. It's something we in the Western world can't really understand. Their attitude. Mm. And you know, their idea was if they can get a free dinner, that's worth completely throwing everything else out the window.
You went to Yugoslavia, which was the country was interested. And it was the year that their war broke out. So he came back and he said, I just got out of Belgrade in time. It's being bombed. So that was a failure. Africa was hit and miss. Kenya, Zimbabwe, they all wanted enormous backhanders. The president's brother-in-law, the president's cousin would insist that he would have another 30%. And in the end, it became too expensive to sell, really. Mm. And Roger was hoping to sell it to small work cooperatives, where 6 or 10 women were making knitwear, because it's very cold at night, of course, in Africa. It's hot in the day, but cold at night. And they were really keen to have thick knitwear they could get up in and, you know, walk to work or walk to school with their children and so on. So we sold a few, but really it was never going to be a proper industry because they just could not stop asking for extra money for backhanders, totally corrupt. So sadly, South Africa was a bit different. You did sell quite, we had a very good agent there, didn't we?
Yes.
But the other countries in Africa, no, it didn't work. Australia and New Zealand, we didn't go to New Zealand, but Roger spent a lot of time going to Australia, selling there. The difficulty with them is that they've only got those big cities which are, you know, 1,000 or 2,000 miles apart. So you can't go from city to city selling. It's just too vast a country. And the agent we had was really only in Sydney. So Australia tried, but really it didn't work well, did it? Because of the difficulty of getting to big enough shops and department stores over vast distances. So sadly, despite your trying to make that work, it didn't. But the big success story really was America, where they are fanatical hobbyists. I've never known a country like them before, being so keen on every kind of hobby. They don't watch much TV, you know, in America. They're just doing things. They're tatting, they're knitting, they're flower arranging, they're sticking bits of paper on stuff. They're doing felting. They're, I mean, extraordinarily active still.
Is that all ages of women?
Yes. Yes. I mean, you were selling knitting kits for teenage girls in Walmart, which I think girls have always been too busy doing something else. But in America, they get bought, don't they? And Martha Stewart knew there was a good market for teenage girls over there.
And did it have the same name when it sold in America?
It was called the Incredible Sweater Machine. It was Bond to begin with, but they didn't know what Bond was. Incredible Sweater Machine. And then the later one was called the Ultimate Sweater Machine, Bond America. So there we are.
Can you just explain again, the difference between the two machines that Roger invented?
Well, no, he had about three. The first one was for double knitting to chunky chenille, mohair, Icelandic yarn. The second one, called the Elite, was for three ply, four ply, double knitting. And then you, because they, some of the stores didn't like the length of the bond, he then cut it in half so that they could snap one half onto the other and make it when they got home, as it were. It was dead easy. It wasn't a difficult thing to do. It was fully assembled, except it was cut in half to make a box half the size. He didn't change anything about it for that model. It was just the name on it and the size was different. The box was different. So, no, he really stuck to that same format because it worked. And it was lightweight.
So how did you market it?
Well, we had, as I said before, we have a lot of help from the yarn companies. They loved it because it knitted a lot of yarn. So from the very first, I was the one doing all the magazine, touring around the magazine, selling the idea of it, because we placed ads, so we were spending money on advertising. And they would do promotions with us, which was marvellous. All the magazines, I mean, Slimming World was a good one, Knitting and Stitching, Women's Own, Women, all those women's magazines, and the hobby magazines, obviously. And they would feature patterns of ours, or they'd do promotions of giving away a kit to go with a machine, or there were prizes, weren't they? We had TV placement once or twice. BBC, I used to get onto Broadcasting House and take a machine, and that would be a placement in a programme. I'd teach somebody how to knit, an actor how to knit. So we had a national advertising campaign. We spent quite a lot of money on national advertising. You'd get quite good deals with some small TV companies sometimes to see how that went. And I think in America we did QVC, which was wonderful. You'd have half an hour with Roger's partner Carrie, and she'd be there demonstrating on a stage with an enormous audience watching. And she would knit an inch a minute, and she'd not stop talking while she was demonstrating. So she'd make something wonderful in half an hour, you see, something with glitter in or something. And someone in the audience would stand up and she'd say, "I made this last night, look at me in my top." You think, wow. And then somebody else would get up and they'd say, "I made this for my little girl." And you'd think, wow, and these people were just, it wasn't that actually,
They weren't planted.
They weren't planted.
No,
and Carrie would say, "Great, and where are you from?" And she'd say, "I'm from Ohio." And it was just amazing. Yeah. We saw these films and we just couldn't believe it. I think Roger was crying. It was wonderful. So the advertising from QVC in America was sensational. We didn't really do anything like that here. It was just the advertising in the press, I say a bit of TV, but because it was an interesting product that made things that looked lovely, people were happy to do promotions with us. And we would do competitions, wouldn't we, as well? Give away Bond knitting machines as competition prizes and things. So we did a lot of publicity, and that's what I'd worked in advertising, and I enjoyed that bit very much indeed. While Roger was concentrating on getting the production flowing, he's an accountant as well, so he did the accounts. All the production was organised by him. He spent a lot of time in the West Midlands seeing to that. He did the foreign sales. When I had two children, he had to do all the foreign sales and I had to take a back seat. So we were a really good partnership and engaged people who were doing the things that we couldn't do.
Mm. Yes, and a significant employer.
Well, yes, 21 in Whitney, and then freelancers, yes, 120 people. And we did make good profits after about 4 years, and plans just straight back into new product development. So it was a tightly run ship, very tightly run. We didn't spend money on, he always had a sort of second or a third hand car. Second-hand furniture from the army supply shop. So we didn't flash money around, but we had loyalty from the staff in Whitney.
That's great. Is there anything else you'd like to tell me about related to the knitting?
Where's this going anyway? What's this?
Well, I've told you about the stores. Independent wool shops, department stores, mail order catalogues, market declining, no. I think that's really, you know, I can't think of anything else.
Just one last question. What do you think about knitting now? How do you view knitting today?
Well, the Chinese manufacturers of knitwear killed it stone dead. I mean, Whitney had a knitting shop until last year. And has Oxford got one? Yes, it's got one. Two, actually.
Mm.
Abingdon's got one. Mm. So there were 10,000 wool shops in Britain when we launched in 1981. We did a survey of them, 10,000. And now maybe there are 200. It's just really gone. And if you're making a sweater now, it would probably cost you £120 in yarn to make something. Whereas then, it was affordable, and you could make it for less than it would cost to buy something comparable. And nowadays, of course, you can't. A ball of wool is probably £8 to £15, and that's only 50 grams. So it's an expensive hobby now, really. And of course, it's still time-consuming. And the number of patterns aren't around, really. We did at one, or interestingly, one point in about 1985. Do you know the name Kay Fassett, the knitwear designer, American? Does it ring bells?
No.
He did multicoloured, exquisite knitwear, mainly by hand. And we met him because Rowan Yarns was always a friend of ours, and he did trade shows together. He used to give us lots of yarn and do joint promotions. And his yarn is still going strong, and it's sold in Liberty's and John Lewis, and it's beautiful. They do a whole range of beautifully spun in Keithley, wonderful colours. And Kay Fassett, the knitwear designer, used to do all their colour ranges for them. And about 1980, I don't know, four, we decided, Roger and I, that we would like to see how a wool shop works and how we could integrate our selling techniques and selling ideas better. So we rented a shop in Notting Hill, and we got one of our staff to set up, and Kaif and Simon from Rowan Yarns came, and we painted it some fabulous mushroom colour, and we filled it totally with Rowan Yarns. And one of our girls worked there, and I worked there on a Saturday. I came in on the train and worked there every Saturday just to see how the bond would work. And we did lessons in the basement. We had a coffee machine going all the time for people who were buying wool and so on. And it was a fabulous experiment to see what happens in an independent wool shop. And we were doing well, but I just couldn't go on. I had a baby by then. I couldn't go on coming down every Saturday to work there. And I think the girl we employed wanted to work somewhere else if she left. And so we let the lease go after 3 years. But it was a very interesting experiment to see how wool is, well, not wool, yarn is sold, how you can make it do better by doing kits and lessons and promotions. And it was a very interesting experiment, a sideshow, if you like, but something that proved we didn't know everything about how a yarn shop worked. And then we did. It was fascinating. And the link with Rowan Yarns and with CAFE was just wonderful, because he was in a different level. You know, he has exhibitions at the V&A, and he's just an amazing man.
Was there anything in particular that you remember thinking, oh, I hadn't appreciated that when it came to selling the yarns in the independent shop?
Well, yes, they could do so much more. I mean, we were doing demonstrations in the shop all the time. Let's say we had the coffee machine going, smell of coffee. Someone's buying £20 worth of yarn. You say, you could see they were there for a bit because they were just choosing a fancy cup of coffee. Oh, yes, I'd love one, thanks. And they'd sit down, have a cup of coffee. And then they'd get the yarn and you'd say, have you seen this latest colour? And it was really selling them a whole idea and then saying, yes, with the bond, we have lessons every, I don't know, Saturday afternoon or whatever it was in the basement. Did we charge for them? I'm not sure we did, actually. But it was selling a package. Mm-hmm. And some wool shops are really quite dreary and mainly sell acrylic. Of course, we don't sneer at acrylic, but it wasn't our favourite yarn. And still isn't. It doesn't wear well, you see, does it? It pills and it, you know, doesn't. And so we prided ourselves on being able to do something a bit special, and it was Notting Hill. And it was called Colourway, and it was a smashing shop. But it was a good thing to try out.
Do you have a favourite wool that you like to work with? Favourite type of wool?
Well, Rowan Yarns is absolutely the tops, and they do tweeds and silk and cotton and a chunky and they do just a wonderful range, Rowan Yarns, and you can still find them in all the better wool shops, and the department stores still stock Rowan, so their range is superb and the colour range is wonderful. You can still get them in John Lewis in Oxford.
And do you still knit now, by hand or by machine?
Well, yes, both. And I'm just about to start a new sweater. It's Icelandic yarn, again, because you can get them direct from Iceland. And it's in white and royal blue stripes. I can't wait to start. I thought I'd do it in the dark days of January, by hand, with big wooden needles. Because it's something you can do when you're watching television or something. The last thing I made on the bond was a sweater 2 winters ago, didn't I? It was an Italian yarn, which was space dyed. Space dyed is when it's got every sort of 10 feet, is the colour changes. So when you knit it up, it looks as if it's terribly clever and you've changed the yarn every 5 rows or something, or you've done Farrah, and it's called space dyeing. It was a space dyed sweater, which I've got. I just loved it to bits. So yes, I haven't used it in the last 2 years, but it doesn't mean to say I couldn't, because I've still got about 5 machines in the house, various decrepitudes, because Roger spent some years taking them apart and rejigging them. So most of my machines have got bits missing and I can't use them.
And could people buy replacement parts? If
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, yes. But they didn't much, did they? Because nothing really...
The machine.
If they were large, they could buy an add-on piece. They could buy another 10 or 20 needles and snap them onto one end. That was jolly useful, because when in the late 80s, you know, fashion got quite big, you wanted to wear something quite big, you could snap on an extra 10 or 20 needles onto the end and make something huge. That was great. But we didn't sell that many replacement things, did we? I'm saying it was made of plastic, but it was a jolly durable plastic.
Oh, yes, it was industrial.
didn't accessories sell more than the bits that you could buy added on sell more?
So you bought the machine that enabled you to knit, and then I know you mentioned Roger invented additional things. So what were the accessories that you could buy to go with it?
Well, we had a counter to count the rows automatically. We had a stitching up gadget, which was very clever for stitching up. I can't really describe it, but it's for sewing up, mm-hmm. a quick gadget, which you could catch both sides on teeth and then sew up. Very clever. You had, what else? You had added sections of the machine that you could add on to make a wider garment. People used to make a lot of blankets and things, and they wanted a great width, you know. We had the magazine, of course, which was always popular. What other accessories did we have? I can't remember either. Pattern books, endless pattern books, endless pattern books. And then, as I say, in America, they wanted other things like a weaving machine and all sorts of other things. Mm. And Carrie invented some things, didn't she? She invented a... Do you know what a French knitter is? It's sort of like a bobbin with nails on the top. She invented a super duper kind of that. She got the habit of inventing things from Roger. And she invented something for Martha Stewart, which was a much bigger, clever, and it was a wind-up one, so you wound it, and this French knitting would come out the bottom, and you could make all sorts of wonderful things with it. So that wasn't Roger. Or did you invent it and pass it on to Carrie? I thought Carrie invented it.
Okay. That's quite a story. Thank you very much. It's fine. I can't get it to turn off.
I can't get it to turn off.
Absolutely. Okay, thank you. Perhaps I'll turn this off.